He let Faith lead him down the driveway, back up the sidewalk. She opened the passenger side door. She waited for him to get in. She got behind the wheel. She threw the gear into drive. The Mini's tires dug up a good portion of Lena and Jared's front yard as she made a wide U-turn.
Fucking motherfucker!
Faith strangled the steering wheel with both hands.
I hate that bitch so much. I mean, seriously. The hate is physically sucking the oxygen out of my blood.
Will looked down at his fists. He was so furious right now that he could barely see. That fucking kid. And Lena. Especially Lena. Will had never hit a woman before. Even when his ex-wife had hounded him, he had never fully lost control. Now it was taking every ounce of self-discipline not to go back and punch Sarah's name out of Lena's filthy mouth. Faith said,
"Okay, deep breath. Let's get past this."
Will wasn't going to get past this. Not until he hurt somebody.
"Another deep breath,"
Faith coaxed. Will could feel his fingernails digging into his palms. He wasn't one of her suspects who needed a fucking time out.
"Okay."
Faith's tone said she was ready to move on.
"Let's focus on what we accomplished in there. We managed to Scooby-Doo 2 new details before shit got crazy."
Will gritted his teeth. He didn't give a shit about details. Faith said,
"One, who gave Nesbitt the money to hire a lawyer? No one sues a dead cop's wife on a contingency."
Will had been a fool for thinking Lena had any saving graces. There was nothing good about her. She had twisted him into a corkscrew, and he hadn't even seen it coming.
"Number two,"
Faith said, oblivious to his rage.
"Truong's mother reported that her daughter thought her roommates were stealing from her. That could be the bad guy taking a trophy."
Will squeezed his fist tighter. He wanted to break something, to hurt something, to kill something.
"We could find out if the women from Nesbitt's articles were..."
"Jesus, Faith!" Will exploded. "What is the fucking point of this? Amanda told us before we went in. McAllister's death was accidental. Thieving roommates and an ambulance chaser aren't clues. And you're right about the woods. The woods are every fucking where."
Faith pursed her lips.
"What, Faith? What's the fucking point of talking about this? Any of this?"
She said nothing. Will realized the seatbelt chime had been going off since they'd left Lena's. He yanked on the belt. The strap caught. He yanked it harder.
"It's bullshit is what it is. All of this is fucking bullshit because Sarah called it. Amanda called it. You called it. Lena lies and Nesbitt lies and..."
Will couldn't get the belt to buckle. The chimes were like a railroad spike in his ears. He said,
"There's nothing here, right? Lena gave us jack shit, just like you said she would. Are you gonna answer me? Are you?"
"Yeah."
"Yeah," he repeated, "which means we wasted the entire fucking day listening to a fucking pedophile, listening to a hateful lying bitch, and dying. Because yes, Faith, here's the answer to your question. Hell fucking yes. The Jeffrey part of this is absolutely killing me. And it's all my fault because Amanda was right about waiting to tell Sarah. But I didn't listen to her, so Sarah's been worrying about Jeffrey all fucking day, not texting me a goddamn thing. And now I'm gonna have to go back and tell her to her face that Lena thinks she's behind some scheme to lock her up for perjury, and don't you spin me some bullshit about lying about what really happened with Lena, because I'm not fucking lying. Fuck!"
He gave up on the seatbelt. The metal buckle hit the window as it reeled back. Will punched the dashboard. Then he punched it again and again.
"Fuck! Fuck! Fuck!"
He pulled the last punch, stunned by his own violence. His fist hung in the air like a hammer. He was sweating, his breath huffing out like a steam engine. The car had shaken with every blow. What the hell was he doing? Will never went off like this. He was the guy who stopped the guy from going off.
Faith slowed the car. She pulled onto the shoulder. She put the gear in park.
She gave Will a moment to come back to his senses. It didn't take long. Shame was his overriding emotion. He couldn't even look at her. Faith said,
I think that's the longest sentence you've ever said to me the entire time I've known you.
Will wiped his mouth with the back of his hand. He tasted blood. His knuckle had busted open from the impact.
I'm sorry.
It's fine, really. This is just the last new car I'll ever drive until my daughter graduates from college.
Will ran his fingers along the dashboard to make sure he hadn't cracked the surface. She said,
I can't believe the airbag didn't go off.
Right?
Faith found a Kleenex in her purse.
New rule. We don't ever talk to Lena Adams ever again.
Will dotted at the blood on his hand. How was he going to tell Sarah about any of this? Will wasn't even sure when the interrogation had taken such a seriously wrong turn. Had Lena been playing them from the beginning? She was like the scorpion riding their backs across the river. Faith's phone started to ring. She told Will,
It's Amanda.
He rubbed his face with his hands. Amanda meant Sarah.
What should Will tell her?
That he wanted Burger King instead of McDonald's? That he was looking forward to a salad? That it would have taken her 2 seconds to text him that they were okay, and maybe he wouldn't have gone into a rage spiral and assaulted Faith's car? The phone kept ringing. Will said,
Answer it.
Faith clicked the button.
We're both here. You're on speaker.
Where have you been?
Amanda demanded.
I've been calling and texting for the last 28 minutes.
Faith mumbled a curse as she clocked the dozens of notifications on her phone.
Sorry, we were interviewing Lena and...
Sarah found something during the examination. Alexandra McAllister was definitely raped and murdered. Sarah confirmed there are links to the Grant County cases.
Will stared at Faith. She had slapped both hands over her mouth in disbelief. Suddenly, everything Lena had said actually mattered. What had they missed? Someone paid the lawyer to sue Jeffrey's estate. Leslie Truong's stuff was missing, but then stuff always went missing. Maybe Katerina was missing something. Maybe not. They couldn't go back and ask Lena to clarify. She had shredded her notebooks.
Will had almost pulled a gun on her husband. Faith had called dibs on punching her in the face.
There was no way either of them could ever be in the same room with Lena Adams again.
There's more, Amanda said. I heard back from the GDOC on who's been sending those articles to Daryl Nesbitt. It's the same benefactor who funded the civil suit against Tolliver's estate.
Okay.
Faith had finally found her voice.
Who is it?
Gerald Catarino, Amanda said. Rebecca Catarino's father.
Chapter 7 Gina Vogel looked up from her laptop and stared out the window. Her eyes struggled to focus on the new perspective. Trees, a bird feeder, wind chimes. She had reached that age where reading glasses stopped being a future indignity and started to become a full-on necessity. She looked down at her computer. The letters were still blurry. She adjusted the font size to the equivalent of the E on an eye exam chart. Then she opened her browser and Googled, If I change font size in my email, will other people know? Because she was not going to let her 12-year-old boss think he was opening an email from his grandmother. Google needed more information than Gina was capable of providing. She closed the laptop and tossed it onto the coffee table. She tried looking at the tree again. Her eye doctor had told her to reset her distance vision at least twice an hour. The advice had sounded silly last year, but now she was obsessively looking at trees every 10 minutes because her vision was so bad that she had to stand up and walk to the TV whenever a character on screen sent or read a text. She stood up and stretched her back, another part of her body that had betrayed her. She was only 43 years old.
But apparently all of those warnings from doctors over the years about eating better and getting more exercise had been correct. Who could have guessed? Her right knee took a few steps to get the hang of walking again. She'd been on the couch for too long. Working from home had its perks, but she was going to have to sit at her desk from now on. Curling onto the couch like a cat was the youthful indulgence. Gina turned on the TV in the kitchen. She watched a few minutes of weather. When the newscaster started to report on a woman's body that had been found in the woods, she changed the channel to HGTV. The only bodies she wanted to hear about belonged to the Property Brothers. She opened the refrigerator. She piled vegetables into her arms and deposited them in the sink to wash. For a few seconds, she contemplated Uber Eats, but statistically, she would eventually reach the age of 44, which was followed by 45, which was practically 50, which meant a healthy salad for dinner instead of a greasy cheeseburger and fries. Or did it? She turned on the sink faucet before she could change her mind. She pulled the strainer out of the cabinet. She reached toward the bowl over the sink. Her fingers did not find the expected scrunchie. Gina was not a disorganized person. She always kept the same scrunchie in the same bowl. It was girly pink with white daisies, purloined from her niece on a family beach vacation over 10 years ago. Gina searched the counters, moving around canisters in the Cuisinart mixer. She bent down and looked under the cabinets. She rummaged through her purse, which was hanging on the back of the kitchen chair. She looked in her gym bag by the door. Then she checked the floor in the hallway, rifled the bathroom shelves, opened every drawer in her bedroom, then in the spare bedroom, then in the living room. She even checked the refrigerator, because once she'd left her phone by the milk. Crap. She stood in the middle of the kitchen, hands on her hips. She never wore the scrunchie outside because the color was embarrassing. And also, her niece had a memory like an elephant and the lung capacity of a spoiled 3-year-old. Still, Gina grabbed her keys off the console table, went outside, and searched her car. She even popped open the trunk. No pink scrunchie. Gina returned to the house. She bolted the door. She tossed her keys onto the hall table. She felt a strange tingling in her body. Had someone been inside the house? She'd had a weird feeling last week, like things had been moved around. Nothing had been missing. Even the scrunchie still had been in its place. Yesterday, she had found a window unlocked. But then it was nice outside. Gina had taken to leaving the windows open during the day. It was possible that she'd forgotten to lock one. Actually, the explanation was more probable than a scrunchie thief targeting the neighborhood. Because who would want her laptop, her iPad, her 55-inch TV, when there was a decade-old pink scrunchie with white daisies just asking for it in the bowl over the sink? She walked back toward the kitchen. She could not shake the unsettling feeling. It was the sort of thing that you couldn't describe, because if you did try to describe it, people would laugh at you for being silly. And she was being silly. She'd left the water running in the sink. The stopper had slipped down into the drain. She was 2 seconds away from flooding the kitchen. Gina wasn't just losing her youth. She was losing her marbles. Chapter 8. Faith hated when men cited their status as a father, husband, or brother as the reason they were taking a stand on issues that affected women, as if raising a baby girl had suddenly made them realize that rape and sexual harassment were actually really bad. But she felt on a personal level that being the mother of a sensitive son and the sister of an obnoxious older brother had taught her how to deal with men when they were in a bad place. You didn't ask them how they were feeling. You didn't badger them to talk. You let them listen to their boring music on the radio, and you took them to the store to buy junk food. She sat in her car while Will paid for his haul inside the convenience store. His jaw was still locked down tight. He was getting that feral look he used to have before Sarah came into his life.
Faith looked down at the text exchange on her phone.
Faith, I just now told Will to tell you, but he already told you, and I'm sorry for being a bad friend. Please forgive me.
Sarah,
thank you.
It's okay. We're all having a difficult day. Talk later.
The return text had been delivered 5 minutes ago. It was a perfectly nice, normal response, unless he'd spent half the day with Will.
Faith couldn't think how to reply.
They had a rule about Will. Sarah had said from the outset that they shouldn't talk about him in a personal way, because Faith was his partner, and she always had to take Will's side. In theory, Faith had understood the reasoning. Their job put them into some tense situations. The guns they carried were not for show.
Now, Faith had a bone-deep appreciation for the rule, because seeing Will so torn up, watching him check his phone every 10 minutes until finally turning it off, made Faith want to rip out Sarah's throat. She returned her phone to the cup holder. She tested herself, letting her mind go back to Lena Adams to see if the blinding hate had lessened even the teensiest bit.
Nope.
The door opened. Will climbed into the car. His arms were full of bags of Doritos, Cheetos, Bugles, and a half-eaten hot dog that he shoved into his mouth before the door was closed. He reached into his jacket pockets and retrieved a Dr. Pepper for himself and a Diet Coke for Faith. His shopping spree had clearly not included Band-Aids. Will was annoyingly cheap about strange things. He'd spooled out toilet paper from the convenience store bathroom and wound it around his bleeding hand.
Do you have any scotch tape?
He indicated the expert wrapping, which hung down like the dirty string on a tampon.
This keeps coming loose.
Faith let out a very loud sigh. She opened the armrest console. She found some bandages in her emergency first aid supply. Elsa or
Anna? There's no
Olaf. Faith sighed again. She found the last Olaf, guaranteeing a screaming fit from Emma when she realized her favorite snowman was
gone. I've been thinking about Lena and
Jared. Will started to peel off the toilet paper. The cheap paper stuck to the wound.
Jared must have been in high school when Lena was working the Caterino case.
Faith opened the Band-Aid with her teeth.
That is some gross math.
Will said,
he's a good-looking kid.
Yeah, Will.
Faith covered his knuckle, which was still bleeding.
Guys you think are complicated and misunderstood in your 20s turn out to be assholes in your 30s.
Will looked at the radio. She tuned in the E Street station. Faith said,
I love hearing old men repeatedly clear their throats.
He turned off the music.
What did you find out about Gerald Caterino?
Faith retrieved her phone. She'd had a few minutes to search and found a lot of information that she should have looked for hours ago.
No criminal background, not even a parking ticket. He owns a landscaping business. The website's pretty fancy. It looks like a legit operation with an office manager, two crew bosses. You want to see?
Will took the phone and scrolled through the site. He clicked to the owner section. Gerald Caterino's photo put him in his mid-50s, which tracked with having a 27-year-old daughter. What was left of his dark hair was streaked with gray. He had a push-broom mustache and wore wire-rimmed glasses.
Faith provided, his bio says his hobbies are gardening, reading with his son, and finding justice for his daughter. Look at this part.
Faith tapped the link. The screen filled with a Facebook page.
Justice for Rebecca,
Faith said. She was never certain how quickly Will could read.
Caterino created the page 5 years ago. There's about 400 followers. It links to a bunch of other Facebook pages for women who have been missing or murdered. Mostly it's parents railing about the police being lazy or stupid or incompetent or basically not doing enough.
31 likes for a donut joke.
Will swiped down the page.
He posted the same newspaper articles that Nesbitt gave us?
The latest one is an AJC story about Alexander McAllister being found yesterday morning.
He's vigilant,
Will said.
Every time someone posts something within minutes, he replies.
Brace yourself. This takes a really dark turn.
She accessed her browsing history, then pulled up the Justice for Rebecca website. Faith pointed to the menus as she read.
The crime, the investigation, the evidence, the cover-up.
She tapped down to a submenu under cover-up. She read the blue hyperlinked words.
Jeffrey Tolliver, Lena Adams, Frank Wallace, Matt Hogan.
Will randomly selected the names. The accompanying photographs had been photoshopped to look like mugshots. A red bullseye was placed over each face, like you'd find on a paper target at a shooting range. Jeffrey Tolliver had a fake bullet hole between his eyes. Faith had seen the images while Will was inside the store, but she still found them deeply unsettling. Legally, they fell under protected speech. There was no way to tell if Katerina was making a joke, engaging in a bit of fantasy, or encouraging violence against the police. As a law enforcement officer, Faith lacked the generosity to give him the benefit of the doubt. Will said,
"A lot of people on the internet do things just because they can do them."
The car was silent for a moment. Will was looking at both sides, but Faith could tell he was just as troubled as she was. He kept staring at the phone. He was probably thinking about what it would do to Sarah to find a photo of her dead husband with a bullet hole photoshopped in his head. Will finally said,
"I don't want Sarah to see this unless she has to."
"Agreed."
He handed back the phone.
"What else is on there? Anything?"
Faith took a breath before jumping back in, because she would never leave the house if she let this kind of shit get to her.
"I skimmed the crime/evidence stuff. The guy likes his adverbs. There's a lot of wild conjecture and conspiracy theory bullshit, but not much in the way of concrete facts. Mostly his focus is on how the police suck, and that they should all be put on death row for not doing their jobs. It comes off like Peppa Pig trying to do John Grisham."
"Death row?"
"Yep."
There was another moment of silence. Will said,
"So is he an acolyte? Copycat? Nutjob? Murderer?"
He was asking the questions they'd volleyed around this morning in the prison chapel.
"I think he's a devastated father, whose daughter was brutally attacked, and he blames the police for ruining both of their lives. If anything, he comes off as a cop-hating Don Quixote."
"You said that Katerina started this online stuff 5 years ago. Becky was attacked 8 years ago. He waited 3 years before he got into it. What set him off?"
"Let's see if he'll tell us."
Faith put the car in gear. She had already entered the address into the navigation system. Lena had done them at least one favor by dragging them down into the belly button of the state. Gerald Katerina lived in Milledgeville, about half an hour outside of Macon. Faith had called his office pretending to need an estimate on landscaping. They had told her that Gerald was working from home today. She had pulled up the county tax records and located Katerino's $240,000 house in an older part of town. Will opened the bag of Doritos.
"We need to know more about the Leslie Truong case. From what Amanda told us, Sarah found the same type of puncture wound in Alexandra McAllister's spinal cord that Becky Katerino had. What about Truong?"
"I bet you Lena drew a diagram in her notebook," Faith said. "Fucking bitch."
"The information will be in the files."
Faith listened to him chew. The files meant Jeffrey's files. Sarah was going to get them out of storage, a detail Amanda had relayed among a long list of tasks the team was expected to complete by the end of the day. Fortunately, Emma was staying with her father this week. The time was already creeping up on 3 o'clock. Faith had been awake since 3 this morning. All she could think about right now was walking through her front door, taking off her bra, and reading escalator fatality stories until it was dark enough to go to bed. Will said,
"It takes 3 murders to make a serial."
"We could have a lot more than that if we can get the bodies from the articles exhumed."
Faith hoped to God she wasn't the person who had to ask the families for permission to dig up their dead children.
"Let's say Gerald Catarino agrees to talk to us. Do we tell him about McAllister's death being ruled a homicide?"
"If we have to,"
Will said.
"We should hold back the bulk of the details, though."
"That's fine with me."
Faith still couldn't wrap her head around what Amanda had told them. Attacking a woman, raping her, terrifying her, murdering her, were all bad enough. To torture her in that way, to paralyze her so she couldn't fight back, was a whole new level of terror. She said,
"Sarah found knife wounds around the abdomen and around the armpits. The killer must know something about animal behavior, right? He sliced open McAllister's skin to draw blood so that the predators would eat the evidence."
Will shoved a handful of chips into his mouth. He was staying away from the Sarah part of the discussion. Or maybe he was still processing the grisly details, the same as Faith. Most killers were not caught because they left at the crime scene a grain of sand from a remote island that only they could have visited. They got caught because they were sloppy and stupid. This killer was neither of those things.
"Brad Stevens."
Will opened the bag of Cheetos.
"He's missing from the list of cops in the cover-up section."
"He must have been fresh out of the academy when this happened."
Faith knew exactly what that looked like.
"He would have been doing the scut work, gathering all the reports, filing, canvassing, door-knocking, talking to secondary witnesses."
"He would have seen everything."
Faith glanced at her partner, who was brushing crumbs off his tie. The more they talked about the case, the better Will sounded. She asked,
"Take me through your thinking. How do you draw the line between Gerald Catarino and Brad Stevens?"
"I'm Gerald Catarino," Will said. "My daughter has been gravely injured. I've got to deal with that in the immediate, right? Her recovery, physical therapy, whatever. And all that time, I'm thinking the guy who hurt her is behind bars. The guy goes through 2 appeals that he loses. 3 years pass. I'm rocking along with my life. But then the guy I think is guilty writes to me and tells me he didn't do it."
Faith nodded, because that seemed like the most likely turn of events.
"You wouldn't believe that guy."
"I would not."
Will dumped the rest of the Cheetos into his mouth. He chewed, then swallowed, then said,
"I'm my dad, though. I can't let it go. I've got this guy who I think hurt my daughter, but he's telling me it was somebody else who's still out there, possibly hurting other women. What do I do next?"
"You're a middle-class white man, so you assume the police will help you."
Faith handed him her Diet Coke to open.
5 years ago, Matt Hogan was gone. So was Tolliver. Frank Wallace was the interim chief. Lena was chief detective. Brad was a senior patrolman."
Will passed back the open soda.
"Frank would be zero help. Lena might try to help, but not in a meaningful way."
Faith could imagine Lena trying to control the situation and watching it blow up like a roadside IED.
"The civil suit wouldn't get Nesbitt access to the Truong and Catarino files. Nesbitt was only the assumed perpetrator. His conviction was based on the child porn."
"Right, but there's only a few ways you can personally sue a cop. Excessive force, a Fourth Amendment violation for unreasonable search and seizure, a charge of discrimination and or harassment,"
Will explained.
"You can't base your case off of one bad act. You need to show a pattern of behavior. That's how they get access to the Caterino and Truong files. They tell the judge they need to look at previous investigations to establish a pattern.
Faith took a sip of cola. As legal strategies went, it was a good one.
Gerald Caterino must have been pissed off when Daryl Nesbitt dropped his suit in exchange for medium security.
He still kept in touch,
Will said.
He sent the articles to Nesbitt in prison.
Just the articles, Faith said, reminding him of the detail Amanda had passed on. There were no letters, no post-it notes, just the clippings in an envelope with a P.O. box for the return address.
GDOC only keeps mail records for 3 years. We don't know if they corresponded before that.
Faith figured Gerald Caterino was the only person who could fill in the details, if he agreed to talk to them.
You still haven't connected this to Brad Stevens.
Easy. Frank and Lena aren't going to help. So I start looking for weak points on the Grant County force. Someone who was there when it happened. Someone who isn't invested in being right. Brad Stevens is my only choice.
Faith didn't buy it.
You're saying he would turn on Jeffrey?
Never. But he would flip on Lena like a pancake.
I thought Brad and Lena were partners.
They were,
Will said.
But he's a Dudley Do-Right.
Faith got his meaning. Brad saw things in black and white, which could make you a good cop, but not necessarily a good partner. No one wanted to work with the tattletale. Will said,
we need to talk to Brad.
Put it on the list behind talking to every detective, coroner, and next of kin involved in every case from Daryl Nesbitt's articles.
Will tipped the bag of bugles into his mouth and finished the last of the crumbs. Then he took a handful of Jolly Ranchers out of his pocket for dessert, and Faith couldn't watch anymore. The sat-nav said to take a right. Faith drove through an older residential area. Tall dogwoods lined the streets. Large shrubs and ornamental trees filled the front yards. The design reminded Faith of her own in-town neighborhood, where hundreds of split-level ranch-style houses had been built for returning World War II veterans. Hers was one of the few remaining homes that hadn't been Frankensteined into a McMansion. Faith's government salary barely covered a broken water heater. If not for her grandmother leaving her the house, she would have been forced to live with her mother. Neither one of them would have made it out alive. She slowed down to read the mailbox numbers.
We're looking for 8472.
There.
Will pointed across the street. Gerald Caterino lived in a fairly modest two-story brick colonial. The lawn was neatly trimmed zoysia that had yet to go dormant from the change in season. Flowers Faith could not name spilled from terracotta pots. Pavers lined the crushed stone driveway. She pulled in front of a closed wrought iron gate that blocked the motor court. She saw a kid playing with a basketball on the other side. He looked around 8 or 9 years old. Faith remembered Caterino's bio from his company website. She assumed this was the son that Caterino liked to read with.
Up top.
Will nodded toward a security camera. Faith scanned the front door. There were two cameras covering each corner. Will said,
that's not something you get on Amazon.
Faith agreed. They look professional. What you'd find in a bank. The gate took on a different meaning. Faith had lived in Atlanta all of her life. She had seen the gate as just another gate. She reminded herself they were in Milledgeville, where the annual murder rate was zero, and every other house on this bucolic tree-lined street probably had unlocked front doors. She said,
his daughter was brutally attacked 8 years ago.
He blames us for what happened after.
Not us personally. He blames Grant County.
Will didn't respond, but then he didn't have to. Gerald Caterino's online activity made it clear that he didn't see the difference. Faith allotted herself exactly 2 seconds to think about the gunshot wound, that had been carefully placed between Jeffrey Tolliver's eyes. She asked,
"Ready?"
Will got out of the car. Faith found her purse in the back seat. She joined Will at the gate. His elbows rested along the top. He watched the kid chunk the ball toward the basket. It missed by a mile, but the boy still looked to Will for approval.
"Wow, that was close."
Will gave Faith a slight nod toward the back of the house.
"Can you do that again?"
The kid happily chased after the bouncing ball. Faith had to go up on her tiptoes so she could see the house. There was a screened porch off the back. The shadows provided cover for the man sitting at the table. He leaned forward into the sunlight. What was left of his dark hair was streaked gray. His push-broom mustache was neatly trimmed. His wire-rimmed glasses were on top of his head.
"What do you want?"
Gerald Catarino's angry tone made the hairs go up on the back of Faith's neck.
"Mr. Catarino?"
She already had her ID ready. She held it up over the gate.
"I'm Special Agent Mitchell. This is Special Agent Trent. We're with the Georgia Bureau of Investigation. We wondered if we could talk to you."
He remained seated at the table, telling the kid,
"Heath, go check on your sister."
Heath let the basketball bounce away as he darted inside. Faith heard a click, then the gate slowly opened. She made herself go first, walking across the driveway, open to anything that might come. The backyard was as huge as it was well protected. She saw a 6-foot-tall chain-link fence around the perimeter. More cameras were mounted under the eaves. A wrought iron fence that matched the gate circled a beautiful swimming pool. A lift chair was mounted to the stone deck. The screened porch was accessed via a ramp instead of steps. There was a large wheelchair van parked in the garage alongside a pickup truck with landscaping tools in the back. The screen door was made of wrought iron that matched the rest. Odd, since the screen could be easily sliced apart. But Faith wasn't here to do a security evaluation. Heath hadn't closed the door all the way. There was no way in hell she was going to step foot on that porch without being invited. The security cameras, the gate, the tall fence, the targets on the Grant County mugshots, the bullet wound in Jeffrey Tolliver's head. Rebecca Catarino had been attacked almost a decade ago. That was a long time to be on high alert. Faith had seen what grief could do to a family, particularly fathers. For all the security, Gerald hadn't stood up to inspect their IDs before opening the gate. The man's online presence was riddled with anti-law enforcement propaganda. She wondered if he wasn't standing up, because he had a gun taped to the underside of the table. Then she wondered if she was being paranoid. Then she reminded herself that paranoia was the thing that got her home safe to her baby girl every day. She realized they were already at a standoff.
"Mr. Catarino, I need your verbal authorization to enter your residence."
His beefy arms were crossed over his chest. He offered a curt nod.
"Granted."
Will reached ahead of her to open the door. Faith kept her purse close to her side. Her bad vibe had crested into a tsunami of red flags. Everything about Gerald Catarino felt charged, ready to explode. He was sitting on the edge of his chair. His arms were still crossed. His laptop was closed. Time cards were stacked beside it. He was wearing black cargo shorts and a black polo shirt. Bright white skin showed between the V of the unbuttoned collar. He had a landscaper's tan that stopped with his work shirt. Faith glanced around. There was another camera, a bubble type, mounted on the ceiling by the kitchen door. The porch was wide and narrow. The table Catarina was sitting at had 3 chairs and an opening for a wheelchair. Faith offered her credentials. Several seconds passed before he took them. He put on his glasses. He studied the ID, comparing the photo to Faith. Will handed over his wallet and received the same scrutiny. Caterino asked,
"Why are you here?"
Faith shifted on her feet. He hadn't told them to sit down.
"Daryl Nesbitt."
Caterino's body grew exponentially more tense. Instead of volunteering that he'd been sending Nesbitt articles for the last 5 years, he looked out at the backyard. Sunlight bounced off the surface of the pool, turning it into a mirror.
"What's he trying to get this time?"
"Ultimately, we think he wants to be moved to a lower security facility."
Caterino nodded as if that made sense, and it probably did. The last time Nesbitt had made a deal, he'd been transferred from Maximum. The move had probably cost Caterino around 100 grand in legal fees. Faith said,
"Mr. Caterino..."
"My daughter was left out in those woods for half an hour before somebody realized she was alive."
He looked at Faith, then Will.
"Do you know what that 30 minutes would have meant to her recovery? To her life?"
Faith didn't think that question could ever be answered, but it was clearly something he was holding on to.
30 minutes, Caterino said. "My little girl was paralyzed, traumatized, unable to speak or even blink, and not one of those filthy fucking cops thought to check to see if she was still alive, to even touch her face or hold her hand. If that pediatrician hadn't just wandered by..."
Faith tried to keep her tone light, as a contrast to the bitterness in his voice.
"What else did Brad Stevens tell you about that day?"
Caterino shook his head.
"Worthless little punk did what they all do. The second you ask a cop to go on the record, they clam up. That thin blue line is like a fucking noose around my neck."
"Mr. Caterino, we're here to get the truth," Faith said. "The only line we care about is the one that separates right from wrong."
"Bullshit. You dirtbags always cover for each other."
Faith thought about Nick grabbing Daryl Nesbitt and throwing him into the wall.
"Worthless fuckers."
Caterino hissed out a long stream of air between his teeth.
"I should have never let you in here. I know my rights. I don't have to talk to you."
Faith tried to deflect with the parent card.
"I've got a son, too. How old is Heath?"
6.
Caterino straightened his laptop on the table.
"My ex-girlfriend, his mother, couldn't handle it when Becky got hurt. We didn't part on good terms. I was really angry back then."
Faith thought he was really angry right now.
"I'm sorry to hear that."
"Sorry,"
he repeated.
"What the hell are you sorry for?"
Faith knew she wasn't responsible, but she felt responsible anyway. The Justice for Rebecca website had dozens of photographs that showed Becky before and after the attack. She was a beautiful young woman who had suffered lifelong damage as a consequence of that day in the woods. Below-the-waist paralysis, speech impairment, vision impairment, traumatic brain injury. According to the site, the attack had left her intellectually disabled to the point that she required round-the-clock care. That 30 minutes in the forest had likely been the last 30 minutes that Rebecca Caterino had ever been left completely alone for the rest of her life. Gerald Caterino pushed his glasses back onto the top of his head. He looked out at the pool again. He had to clear his throat before he could speak.
12 years ago. I truly believe that the worst thing that would ever happen to me was losing my wife. Then 8 years ago, my daughter goes off to college and she comes back like..."
His voice trailed off.
"Do you know what's worse than both of those things, Special Agent Faith Mitchell?"
Faith could tell this was a game he'd played before. You could not guess what was worse than losing someone you loved. You could only pray that it would never happen to you. Caterino said,
"What about you, Special Agent Will Trent? What's worse? What's the worst thing that the two of you could do to me right now?"
Will didn't hesitate.
"We could give you hope."
He looked sucker punched. His eyes began to water. He nodded once, He looked back at the pool. Will said,
I'm sorry, Mr. Catarino. We're not here to give you hope.
His throat worked again. Faith realized that what she had taken for anger could actually be Gerald Catarino's way of coping with fear. He had spent years trying to avenge his daughter. He was terrified that he would spend another 5, 10, 30 years without finding closure. Will asked,
Can you tell us why you mailed those articles to Daryl Nesbitt?
Catarino shook his head.
That sneaky piece of shit is so crooked that he should have joined the police force.
Will asked,
Why those articles in particular?
Catarino looked up at Will.
What does it matter?
Will said,
That's why we're here, Mr. Catarino. We're investigating the deaths from the articles.
Investigating?
He laughed, disbelieving.
Do you know how much money I've wasted on private investigators? Plane tickets and train tickets and hotel rooms to talk to other parents? Criminal psychologists and retired police officers and even a damn psychic. All because you self-serving lazy-ass scumbags can't do your jobs right in the first place.
Faith wasn't going to give him an opening to launch a screed against the police. I'm sure you're aware that Alexander McAllister's body was found yesterday morning in the woods. He defensively shrugged a shoulder.
News said it was accidental.
Faith waited for Will's silent okay before saying, We haven't released this information yet, but McAllister's death has been ruled a homicide. Catarino's eyebrows furrowed in confusion. He wasn't used to hearing things that he wanted to hear.
Why?
The medical examiner found a puncture wound in the back of her neck. Catarino stood up slowly. His mouth opened, but he offered no words. He looked stunned, disbelieving, confused. Faith said, Mr. Catarino?
Was it?
He covered his mouth with his hand. Beads of sweat dotted his bald head.
Was the puncture at C5?
Will said,
Yes.
Without another word, Gerald Catarino ran into the house. Faith watched him jog down a long hallway. Then he turned right. Then he was gone. Will said,
Huh.
Faith mentally ran through the conversation. He warned us not to give him hope.
Then we gave him hope.
She felt an unwelcome shiver down her spine. She told herself Catarino had urgently needed the bathroom. Then she told herself he was going to get a gun. The website rants and doctored photos were still fucking with her. A lot of people talked about killing the police. There were even songs about it. Only a very small number were willing to act on the threat. Telling the difference between the two was easy. The first group did nothing. The second group pointed a gun at your head and pulled the trigger. Faith looked at Will to check her crazy. He asked,
Homicide or suicide?
So crazy confirmed. Heath is in the house. Probably Becky, too.
I'm with you.
Faith walked into the house. The kitchen was filled with light and very familiar. She could see child locks on all the cabinets and drawers. The outlets were covered. The hard edges had foam padding. At 6, Heath was too old for baby-proofing measures. This must have been for Catarino's 27-year-old daughter, Becky. Faith turned to find Will. He was looking at a security camera mounted on the shelf between stacks of cookbooks. He raised up on his toes to see the tops of the cabinets. He made a hand gesture, thumb cocked, finger extended, to indicate a gun.
Hey there, y'all!
A woman wearing a nurse's uniform came into the kitchen. An empty sippy cup swung from her hand.
Are you visiting Gerald? That fool just ran up the stairs.
Faith felt her anxiety ease down a notch. Another person. A witness. She did the proper introductions, showing her ID. The woman didn't seem puzzled or alarmed to find two special agents in the kitchen.
I'm LaShanda.
She rinsed the cup at the sink.
I look after Becky during the day.
Faith figured she should take advantage of the opportunity.
How's she doing?
Today is good.
LaShanda smiled brightly.
She struggles with depression. That's the brain injury. Sometimes she acts out, but today is a good day.
He skipped into the room before Faith could ask what a bad day looked like. He grinned like a jack-o'-lantern.
Here.
Heath showed Will a drawing that was a very impressive tyrannosaur for a 6-year-old. Will studied the artwork.
This is incredible, buddy. Did you do this all by yourself?
Heath turned shy, hiding behind LaShanda's leg.
He's adorable, Faith told the woman. How old is he?
6, but he'll be 7 in 2 months. Sweet Lamb is a Christmas baby.
You are a big boy for 6 years old.
Faith leaned down to Heath's level.
I bet you know how to add. What's 2 plus 2?
4.
Heath's grin was back. One of his permanent front teeth was growing in crookedly. She asked,
Which hand do you write with?
Right!
He shook his right hand in the air.
Did you tie your own shoes today?
Yes!
He threw his arms up like Superman.
And I made my bed, and I brushed my teeth, even the loose one, and I...
All right, little man, they don't want to hear about every part of your day.
LaShanda ruffled his hair.
Why don't y'all come through to the den? There's no telling how long Gerald will be gone.
Faith was happy to follow her through. She was still very uneasy about Caterino's abrupt disappearance. Without the deranged online stuff, she would have called him strange. But then there was the deranged online stuff.
Through here.
LaShanda took them down the long hallway. They passed the formal dining room. Textbooks were spread across the table. Faith asked,
Homework?
Heath's homeschooled. His teacher just left.
Faith knew that there were plenty of good, legitimate reasons to homeschool a kid. But during the course of her career, she had only ever dealt with the whack jobs who wanted to keep their children out of public schools for fear that they would be taught controversial topics, like that incest was wrong and slavery was bad. There were no giant swastikas on the walls. She saw framed prints and photographs of Becky at various stages of life. Faith recognized the typical school photos with apples and stacks of books and spinning globes. Becky had been a runner. In one picture, she stood with a group of girls in track uniforms. In another, she broke through the tape at the finish line. The photos ended abruptly after high school. Faith realized there were no pictures of Heath, not even snapshots. Gerald had mentioned him in his website bio, but there were no images online either. She glanced up as they walked into the den. The ceiling was at least 20 feet high. A balcony bowed out from the loft space on the 2nd floor. An elevator had been retrofitted to provide access to both levels. Faith checked her watch again. Gerald Caterino had been gone for 4 minutes. She turned to catch Will's eye. He was looking up at the loft, clearly making a tactical assessment. Faith was glad to see she wasn't the only suspicious nut in the room.
Miss Becky? LaShanda said. Look here. Your daddy has some visitors.
Becky Caterino's wheelchair was facing a set of large windows overlooking the backyard. There was a garden with flowers and concrete yard animals and a fountain that had clearly been created for her enjoyment. Faith saw a ruby-throated hummingbird at the feeder.
Becky?
LaShanda repeated. The girl's hands worked as she turned the chair. She had a hairbrush in her lap. Her house dress was pink. Her pastel blue socks were covered in pink bunny rabbits.
Hello.
Becky smiled with half of her mouth. One eye focused on Faith. The other appeared vacant. Faith recognized the facial paralysis from her grandmother, who'd had a series of strokes before she'd died. This young woman was a few decades too soon for that.
Let me get this for you.
Lashanda wiped Becky's mouth with a tissue. Faith saw a faded T-shaped scar that crossed her throat and ran down her sternum.
This is Miss Mitchell and Mr. Trent.
Nice to...
Becky swallowed before she could push out the rest of the sentence.
Meet you.
You too, Becky.
Faith tried to keep her tone level, because her inclination was to talk to this grown woman like she was a child. There was something so innocent about her. She was very thin. Her movements were awkward as she picked up the brush with both hands. She'd clearly just had a shower. Her hair was damp. She was wearing what looked like fresh clothes. Heath climbed into his sister's lap. He leaned his head against her chest. Faith remembered how sweet Jeremy had been at that age. Her adorable little boy had been on the precipice of transforming into the Marquis de Sade of Y.
Here.
Becky held out the brush to Lashanda.
Braid.
Sweet girl, you know I don't know how to do that.
Lashanda told Faith.
She wants her hair braided like Elsa. I watched a YouTube video, but it did not go well.
Will cleared his throat. He asked Becky,
I can do it if you want.
She smiled, offering him the brush.
Mind if I turn your chair?
She nodded, her smile brightening. Will turned Becky so that she was facing back into the room. Coincidentally, this also gave him a better view of the loft area. He gently brushed out her long hair. Heath was watching, so he explained,
You start with three separate strands.
Will made quick work of the braid. Faith realized that Sarah wore her hair the same way on the weekends. There was an alternate Faith who could have ended up with Will if she hadn't been perpetually drawn to feckless, fertile jackasses. All she could hope for now was a man who remembered to drink water.
Hold on, Lashanda said. Let me get something to tie that off with.
Will pinched the end of the braid while she searched the desk. He winked at Heath.
Up here.
Gerald's head peered over the balcony.
I'm ready for you. Don't let anyone else follow you.
He disappeared again. Will passed the ends of the braid to Lashanda, who answered his questioning look with a shrug of her shoulders.
That's just Gerald, she said. He's got his own way of doing things.
Will did not let Faith go up the stairs ahead of him. He waited until they were on the landing to adjust his jacket. He kept his Glock in a side holster. Because Faith had assumed she would be working in a prison all day, she had put a revolver inside a Crown Royal bag inside of her purse. In the interest of being overly cautious, she unzipped her purse. She made sure the string was loose around the top of the bag. She was reminded of her patrol days. Traffic tickets, grand theft, domestic violence. They had all been routine, until they weren't, because people were people, and you never knew what they were really thinking until they showed you. Will had spotted another camera mounted at the top of the stairs. Faith's paranoia ramped up again. Gerald could be watching their approach. He hated cops. He was nursing a grudge. He had thus far proven to be unpredictable. They took a left down the hallway. Will stopped. He knelt down on the floor. He picked up a tuft of pink fuzz. Insulation. He pointed up at the ceiling. The attic stairs had recently been pulled down. He told Faith,
I'm not liking any of this.
Faith didn't like it either. She called out,
Mr. Catarino?
In the bedroom, Gerald said. Make sure you're alone.
His voice had come from the opposite side of the loft, down what felt like a 200-yard-long hallway. He'd run off twice already. He had a gun downstairs. He probably had one upstairs. He had recently been in the attic. He kept telling them to come alone. Faith followed Will toward the bedroom. Both of their heads swiveled with each door they passed. Hall bathroom? Laundry room? Heath had decorated his walls with dinosaurs and Toy Story characters. Becky's space was filled with medical equipment, a hospital bed, and a transfer hoist. The spare bedroom opposite must have been for the night nurse. Faith wondered how much money all of this cost. Becky would have qualified for disability, but that was like saying a sucking chest wound qualified for an ACE bandage. They had reached the loft. Toys were scattered around a television. Faith recognized the game console as a newer version of the one she had at home. To get to the last stretch of hallway, she had to step over a plastic cord cover that was approximately the size of a speed bump. There were no cords inside. The barrier was meant to stop Becky's chair.
"Fuck,"
Will muttered. Faith looked past him into the bedroom. No lights were on. The windows were blocked by IKEA-looking cubicles packed with folded clothes. Slashes of sunlight cut around the shelving units. Will took 6 long steps and entered the room. Faith stayed in the hall. She watched him wipe his mouth on the back of his hand. The Olaf bandage flapped back. He'd sweated through the adhesive.
"Mr. Caterino, was that a gun by your bed?"
Gerald said,
"Oh, yeah, I'll
get it."
Will left her sightline. Faith's revolver was out of the bag, in her hand, and ready to go. She was about to swing into the room when Will reappeared in the doorway. He had a Browning high-power 9mm in his hands. Faith wasn't up on weaponry the same way that Will was, but she knew the pistol had a tricky magazine disconnect. Either Gerald Caterino knew his way around a firearm, or someone had sold him more gun than he needed. Will dropped the magazine. He switched on the overhead lights. Faith put her revolver back in her purse, but she kept her hand inside. She visually swept the room as she crossed the threshold. Windows clear? Doorways clear? Hands clear. This was obviously where Gerald slept. The decorations were non-existent. Unmade king-sized bed, mismatched night tables, a television on the wall, the IKEA cubicles, a master bath through one door. The door to what she assumed was a walk-in closet was shut. A key stuck out of the deadbolt lock. Gerald told Faith,
"Close the door."
Faith pushed the door just shy of closing. Gerald said,
"I don't like to talk about this in front of Heath. And I'm not sure what Becky knows or what she can retain. She doesn't remember the attack, but I worry about her hearing things. Or seeing this."
He turned the key and pushed open the door. Faith felt her jaw drop. The walls of the walk-in closet were lined with newspaper articles, printed pages, photographs, diagrams, notations. Colored thumbtacks held everything in place. Red, blue, green, and yellow string connected various pieces. File boxes were stacked floor to ceiling along the back. He had turned his closet into a major incident room, and he was terrified that his children would find it. Faith's heart broke for the father. Every single sheet of paper, every thumbtack, every string was a symbol of his torment. Gerald said,
"I'll keep the key to the closet hidden in the attic. Heath likes to play with my key ring. He almost got in here once. I trust LaShanda, but she can get distracted. If Heath ever saw this, I don't want him to know. Not until he's ready. Please, let me show you."
Faith closed and locked the bedroom door. She took out her phone as she followed Will into the closet. She turned on the video. For the benefit of the recording, she asked, "Mr. Caterino, is it okay if I document this with my phone?"
"Yeah, sure."
Gerald started pointing, first at the photographs.
"I took these the first day Becky was in the hospital, about 12 hours after she was attacked. This incision here is from the tracheostomy. This is where her sternum was broken to save her life."
His finger moved down.
These are her x-rays. You can see the skull fracture very clearly in this one. Look at the shape of it.
Faith zoomed in on the x-ray, which was pinned beside an older-looking crime scene photo.
Did you get copies of your daughter's case files from Brad Stevens?
Gerald's mouth opened, then closed.
I got them. That's all that matters.
Faith let it go. He'd saved her some time, at least. She zoomed in on the witness statements, investigation notes, coroner's reports, resuscitation notes, scene of crime diagrams. Will had his hands in his pockets. He was leaning forward, looking at a photograph of a young woman standing near the Golden Gate Bridge. He asked,
Is this Leslie Truong?
I was refused access to her file because it's still technically an open case,
Gerald said.
Her mother, Benita, gave me that picture. We used to talk all the time. Not so much anymore. After a certain point, it just eats you up, you know? Your life gets...
He didn't have to finish the thought. The walls told the story of his life after Becky's attack. Faith turned, working in a grid to slowly video the wall behind her. Gerald had printed out pages and pages from the internet. She saw Facebook posts, tweets, emails. She zoomed in close to make sure she got the senders. Most of the emails were from D. Masterson at Love to See Murder. She asked Gerald,
Did you get access to any of the case files from the newspaper articles?
I filed requests through the Freedom of Information Act, but there was nothing in the files. Barely more than a few pages on each woman.
He pointed to the corresponding section of wall.
All of them were classified as accidents, the same way Becky's would have been if she hadn't lived. Not that her life was what it was before. Not that it ever will be again.
The desperation in his voice was like a vice closing down on the room. Will said,
Mr. Caterino, you mailed those specific newspaper articles to Nesbitt for a reason. What made you choose them?
I talked to the families.
Gerald sprinted toward the back of the closet. He stood beside the filing boxes.
Look, here are my call notes. Give me notes.
Faith swung the camera around. She wanted Gerald on the recording, too. He said,
I made dozens of phone calls. Every time a woman was found, I tracked down the family and spoke to them. I was able to narrow down the victims to wait.
He pointed behind Faith, but she didn't turn. She recognized the women's faces from the newspaper articles, but the photographs on the wall were different, more personal, the kind of thing you would keep in a frame on your desk. Gerald pointed to each woman, calling out their names.
Joan Feeney, Bernadette Baker, Jessica Spivey, Rennie Seeger, Pia Dansky, Charlene Driscoll, Deundra Baum, Shay Van Dorn.
Faith zoomed in on each, making certain to keep Gerald in the frame. He pointed again, saying,
Headband, comb, barrette, hairband, brush, brush, scrunchie, comb.
Wait, Faith said. What are you talking about?
That's what they were missing. Didn't you look into this? Haven't you read anything?
Mister.
No!
He yelled.
Don't tell me to calm down. I told that fucking cop that Becky was missing the hair clip her mother gave her. It was tortoiseshell. Becky accidentally broke one of the teeth. She always kept it on her bedside table the morning she went out.
He ran back across the room.
Look, it says it right here. Kaylee Pierce, her roommate. This is her official statement.
Faith had followed him with the camera.
Kaylee said that the morning Becky was found, before that, when she was getting dressed, she said...
He was breathless.
She said...
Faith told him,
It's okay, Mr. Caterino, look at me.
He looked at her with a piercing desperation. Take your time. We are listening to you. We are not going anywhere.
Okay. Okay.
He tapped his fist over his heart as he tried to steady himself.
Kaylee said that Becky couldn't find her hair clip on the nightstand. It wasn't there that morning. The nightstand is where she always left it. Even before Becky went away to college, she left the clip on the side of her bed. She didn't want it to get damaged, but she wanted to wear it when she needed to be close to Jill, all right?
Jill was her mother?
Yes, right.
Gerald pointed to a photograph of Becky before the attack. She was reading in bed. Her hair was clipped back.
The hair clip was never found. The girls, Kaylee and her roommates, they turned the dorm upside down, okay? Before the police even did their search. Not that they searched much, because at that point they didn't care. But the girls knew how much the hair clip meant to Becky. So while she was in the hospital, they looked for it. And they didn't find it. And when the cops bothered to actually investigate what happened, they didn't find it either.
Faith bit the tip of her tongue. She could not believe that this was a detail Lena Adams had forgotten.
Those cops, Gerald said. Tolliver, he was the worst. He came across all sympathetic, like he cared, but he just wanted to tick a box and clear this case so he could keep getting paid.
Faith knew what a cop's paycheck looked like. It hardly inspired motivation.
He told me. That lying fucking asshole told me.
Gerald cut himself off, trying to regroup.
Tolliver framed Nesbitt. I'll tell you that. If I could prove it, I'd sue that town to the ground. You know the college paid out, right? And the county. They knew that police force was corrupt. That's why they paid through the nose.
Faith was suddenly glad that she was filming the man who sued police departments. She asked, was there a trial for damages?
They didn't want a trial because they knew all the incriminating details would come out. Don't you see? The insurance company, the town, the lawyers, even my own legal team. They were all part of the cover-up.
In Faith's experience, legal teams did whatever they could to get the largest payout. Gerald said,
the county settled with me, but they wouldn't say they did anything wrong, even though we know they did. We know they did. 30 goddamn minutes. 30 minutes of my daughter's life. I'm breaking that non-disclosure agreement right now. I should have gone on the news. I still could go. Let them try to claw the money back. I dare them.
Faith moved her thumb to cover the microphone, even though it was too late. Gerald told Faith,
you have a son. How are you going to feel when you send him off to college? You trust him, right? You trust the police. You trust everybody to look out for your kid. And when they don't, you make them pay.
Will cleared his throat.
How much did they pay?
Not enough.
Gerald looked around the room. His lips started to quiver.
Not fucking enough.
His voice had raked up on the last word, cut off by a sob. He covered his mouth, trying to keep it in. Gerald lost the battle. He bent over at the waist. A distraught wail seeped from his lips. His knees gave out. He dropped to the floor. He covered his face with his hands. He started keening like a child. Faith turned off the video. Will stopped her from going to Gerald. He found a box of Kleenex in the corner. The trash can beside it was already overflowing. Gerald's head was pressed to the carpet. His sobs filled the room. Comforting him wasn't the answer. You could not comfort hope. Will knelt down. He offered him the Kleenex.
I'm sorry.
Gerald took a tissue. He wiped his eyes.
This happens sometimes. I can't stop it.
Will helped the father stand. Gerald blew his nose. His face was red. He was embarrassed. Faith gave him a few more seconds before leading him back to the present. Mr. Caterino, downstairs, when my partner told you the spinal cord damage was C5, that seemed to set you off. He blew his nose again, straightened his shirt.
Becky had a puncture.
He pointed to a black and white image on the wall.
I was going to take this to you downstairs, but I thought it was better to bring you up here and show you. There's so much, and I don't...
It's okay, Faith soothed. I'm glad you allowed us to see this. It's important that we keep all of the hard work you've done intact.
Okay. You're right.
He pointed to the wall again.
This is the puncture.
She turned the video back on. She zoomed in on the black and white image, which was taken from an MRI. Even to her untrained eye, she could see the damage to the spinal cord, like a tire puncture from a cartoon, with fluid seeping out instead of air. He said,
No one could explain it.
Is there anything else about your daughter's case that we should know about?
It's all lost. The leads have gone cold. There's no one to talk to. No one who will talk about it anyway.
Gerald threw away the Kleenex.
Tolliver worked his ass off to make sure we never found out the truth about Becky and Leslie. He hid information, claimed it was lost in the bureaucratic shuffle. And his sycophant, Lena Adams. Did you know she shredded all of her notebooks? Can you imagine what she wrote down? She's the bitch who didn't even check to see if my daughter was dead or alive. All of them were standing around laughing and joking while she suffered catastrophic brain injuries.
Faith steered him away from that rocky shore.
Tell me more about Becky's hair clip.
Yes, he said. It was missing, which means nothing on its own, right? But then I talked to Benita.
Leslie Truong's mother?
Faith tried to slow him down again.
What did she say?
Gerald's tears had dried. He was angry again.
Leslie was missing a headband that she always wore when she washed her face at night.
Was the headband the only thing that she was missing?
Yes.
He hesitated, then admitted,
I don't know. Maybe some shirts, some clothes, but definitely the headband. Leslie specifically called Benita to vent. It was stupid, she said, to steal something of such little value. That's what made her so angry, because why would you take something like that?
Faith thought back through the other possible victims, the other possible items stolen.
Shay Van Dorn was missing a brush?
A comb. She was in her car when she realized it was gone. She was so upset that she told her mother about it.
He went back to the photographs of the women from the articles.
Joan Feeney. She wore a headband at the gym. She told her sister that she couldn't find the purple one, which was her favorite. Seeger was in her car, like Van Dorn. She was on the phone with her sister when she mentioned that the blue elastic hairband she kept in the console wasn't there.
Faith nodded for him to continue.
Dansky had a silver brush that belonged to her grandmother. It was missing from her dresser. Driscoll kept a brush in her glove box. It wasn't there when her husband checked. Spivey had a barrette in her desk at work that she used to clip back her bangs. Baker had a comb with the word chillax written in crystals. Baum's sister says she always coordinated her scrunchie with her outfits. She was found wearing a green shirt, but no scrunchie. And then when the sister checked her things, she found all kinds of scrunchies, red, yellow, orange, but no green.
Faith thought about a defense attorney using the video as evidence that Gerald Caterino had planted thoughts in the heads of desperate family members. In a harsher light, what the father had done could be called witness tampering. And for what? A brush. A comb. A scrunchie. A headband. A hair clip. Between Faith's car, purse, and house, she had all of those items, some in multiples. It would be very easy for someone to say after the fact that any one of them was missing. especially if they were desperately reaching for connections.
Will was obviously thinking the same thing. He waited for Faith to stop the recording. He asked Gerald,
"When you called the families, what was that like?" "Some of them wouldn't talk to me. Others were a dead end. I had a list of questions to screen them out. That's how I narrowed it down to the 8 victims."
He went to the opposite wall. He ripped a sheet of notebook paper out from a thumbtack.
"This is what I used."
Faith read the list. 1. Introduce yourself. Be calm. 2. Explain what happened to Becky. Just the facts. 3. Ask if they have any suspicions about their loved one's cause of death. Act normal. 4. Ask if their loved one mentioned anything was missing. 5. Ask them to confirm absence of missing item. Gerald explained,
"Every time I read a news story, I go to work. There's a lot of stuff on the internet. People are easy to find. What I do is make a call. I've talked to dozens of victims' family members over the years. I think I've gotten better at it. You have to feel them out, make sure they're open to the possibility. It's a horrible thing to lose a child, but it's even more horrible to realize that she was stolen from you."
Faith reread the list, which offered a textbook example of leading questions.